You're listening to the Bill McIntosh Show.
And he took that crutch and he actually pushed the police line. I mean, he moved 6-7 officers, all of them. He pushed them all back. It was the people that saw that said that was superhuman strength. And when he did that, the bystanders rushed up and they grabbed Roseanne's arms and they dragged her down the steps and started CPR. Because up till that point, she was getting no life-saving support. And then they started doing CPR.
Amazing. Okay, so that was it. What a tragedy that was. And then the gratuitous violence of that person who obviously must have known. I mean, she's lying down, I guess, face down or face up. It must have been face up or what?
She was on her side. And Lila Morris, the officer, was swinging so hard and fast that after the three hits, she was going for a fourth hit, and she swung so hard, the stick flew out of her hand, and it bounced off the ceiling and landed somewhere else. But she then continued to swing with nothing in her hands. Yeah.
Obvious. I mean, what's the point? She's basically sort of like de facto torturing her to move on, and she's unconscious.
Yeah. And just absolutely dragged, appalling. Literally dragged into the tunnel by other officers, and she collapsed, and we've got her video, and she went into histrionics, and I can't breathe, and
wait, that's the officer.
The officer. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yes. Good. So she began to play victim herself.
Yes.
Oh gosh.
Yes.
On and cue. Very good.
On the video.
Pathetic.
Roseanne. Eventually, her would-be rescuers, there were about six men that were trying to defend and help her, carried her right, and they put her down right in front of the police line. And one man continued to do CPR. The rest of them said, here. They basically said, here, help her. And eventually, one of them grabbed her arm, and they dragged her in. It was pathetic. I mean, I in the film, I liken it to dragging a deer carcass out of the woods. That's what it reminded me of. And no care.
Wow.
Didn't even lift her above the ground. They dragged her, and she lost a lot of her clothing. But once she passed inside the building, there were FBI special ops, SWAT people in there. They immediately, and I mean, as soon as they saw her, they started doing CPR. They got defibrillator paddles. She got first class, very aggressive help, but she was already dead. Had she gotten in there sooner, or if they had gone out, or if the police that were in the tunnel had done the same thing,
if a police officer hadn't bashed her in the head like an absolute goon, right? I mean, is that inaccurate to make that statement?
No.
That's the question.
I don't, there's no explanation. I don't think there's any justification for that when this poor woman had been laying there lifeless for at least 5 minutes. She hadn't so much as twitched
Amazing.
A muscle. She was not a threat to anyone. So,
wow. Another Ashley Babbitt, basically. Then what happened? Like, let me go on and ask about Kevin Greeson. It's one of the other victims, right?
Yeah, Kevin Greeson and Benjamin Phillip had very similar stories. They were out in the crowd, and this on the west side. This was a very tightly packed crowd, and there were a lot of people there. And this was right at the time when the police decided they were going to use explosives. They were going to toss out flashbangs and dispersion grenades. Some of which emit tear gas, others, fire out plastic pellets. And this is on top of officers who were standing above and firing rubber bullets from rubber bullet basically rifles. And both of them were in near proximity to an explosion from one of these incendiaries. And one of the problems when you're lobbing these things from above is they were tending to explode at head level. And we've got some clips of that in the film. You can see it's even just above head level when they start to burn, and then boom, right at, like, literally at eye level. And one witness said they saw Greason struck by some sort of a projectile.
It
could be a triggering event. Both were ruled natural causes because they both had severe heart disease. But, that kind of an explosion, and these things knock people off their feet. That's how powerful some of these are. You'd see a group of four or five people go down when one of these would explode. Logic would tell you that there's at least a possibility that was a precipitating event, and both of them went into almost immediate cardiac arrest.
Wow.
And neither could be resuscitated. Those two, clearly, considering that use of the dispersion grenades, and our use of force expert said there was no tactical reason to do that. They did not have a tactical goal here. It was pure punishment. That's how he put it. He called it a shooting gallery, and he said it was reprehensible, I think was the word he used.
Wow. So, and by the way, I mean, is this, I have read, I wonder what your take is on this, or what you've been told and what you've learned, investigating this and if proper procedures were followed. But my understanding is that using some of these devices, rubber bullets, and I don't think they use rubber bullets, but some of these types of devices can be fatal if you're hitting the head with it from a certain range. It can be lethal, right?
Yes. In fact, I have a story that will be coming out shortly profiling a gentleman from Pennsylvania who was shot point blank in the leg by a 40 millimeter shell that exploded, and it shattered his femur. He ended up having to have rather complicated surgery, about a foot long titanium, called a pole, but a titanium implement with 14
prosthesis.
Screws to hold his
that's a devastating injury.
It took him six months to be able to walk, and we're sorting through video trying to identify which officer, because there were some that were wielding those things like a handgun or a short rifle. And what the manufacturers of most of these things say, if you're under 30 feet, you risk killing people, that they are not meant for close quarters. Now they do make some things that are for closer quarters use, foam
bean bags,
projectiles, bean bags, things like that. But, this one struck him with such force that, of course, we'll never know exactly what it was. But virtually all these shells have a warning from the manufacturer that if you use them a shorter distance than 30 to 40 feet, you risk serious injury or death. So, walking across the police line, and we have video of an officer doing that, shouting and wielding this like he was about to fire on people that were 5 or 6 feet away from him.
Oh, my gosh. How fast do they travel per second? What's their muzzle velocities, I wonder.
I don't know. It depends.
That's okay.
On the,
that's not to put you on the spot, because, somebody
that,
works.
If it hits you in the head, it very likely would kill you at that kind of a distance,
give you compound fracture. It's unbelievable. Yeah, I think these things have some significant velocity. It's not like a bullet, but sure. So, there's another issue here that, and we've been kind of like dancing around it, which is the whole topic of entrapment. Did the ABC agencies like the FBI use any type of entrapment, or that in conjunction with the Capitol Police, in conjunction with anybody, you know, is there any indication that there might have been entrapment, anything in disturbing indications that mean that we really need to dig deeper, and they raise a lot of questions and a lot of eyebrows about possible entrapment?
The mere presence of all these suspicious actors, if they were put there that day by anyone in government, that immediately raises the specter of entrapment for everyone. Now, we don't have evidence at this point, but we are, the defense attorneys are also working at identifying these people. You're going to start using some of the same technology that the FBI uses to identify people, facial recognition. If they are tied to, and we know the FBI had agents embedded in the crowd, we know that the Metropolitan Police had people dressed like reporters and videographers embedded in the crowd, and we know there was actually regular Army Special Forces from Fort Belvoir nearby who were embedded around the Capitol, and at least according to Newsweek, they had shoot-to-kill authority. They didn't shoot to kill that day, but they had that authority. That raises a serious issue of the Posse Comitatus Act, where using regular military for law enforcement domestically is strictly prohibited. And so that's a big, big question that has not been answered, and one that I suspect is going to come up in more than a few trials. We have a video from a gentleman, a journalist originally from Michigan. He is certain that they are both FBI agents. One of them is pulling the glass out of one of the windows and telling him and others, why don't you break out the rest of it here and go on in?
This bothered people.
Yeah. And there was another fellow, again, dressed exactly how you'd expect an agent to dress or law enforcement, holding open the Columbus doors, the inner ones, with a long wooden pole. And so he stood there for quite a while, holding the door open and pushing some people into the foyer, including the cameraman that took the video of it. And eventually, you know, he got a puff of tear gas in his face, and that took him out. But he had been there for quite a while, and Bobby Powell is the cameraman. He has been on a crusade ever since to try to get law enforcement to take his video, and he reported it immediately to the FBI, and they've not gotten back to him, and he's tried giving it to all sorts of lawmakers, and it's like it's too hot to handle. But we use his video in the film, and I've written about him as well. It's, we just don't know who these people are. And they're not being sought. They're not on any list. They're not on the FBI site. They're not on Sedition Hunters. So who are they?
Wow. So many questions.
You know, when I first wrote about January 6th, back in December and January, I called it A Legacy of Troubling Questions. And that title still fits perfectly, and even more so, because the troubling questions pile has just gotten bigger and bigger and bigger.
Right. So then there were supposedly suspicious people changing out of their clothes and into red-colored clothing that you'd associate with Trump supporters, MAGA supporters, you know. You've seen those.
I
don't know if they've
seen that video. And there were some inside the Capitol that were changing as well. In fact, Zachary Alam, after Ashley Babbitt was shot, he opened his backpack and appeared to be changing his shirt. There were at least a few anecdotal instances of that, which again raises suspicions. Who were they? What were they doing there? And they were changing out of Trump colors. So, you add all this stuff up, and it's a cauldron of stink.
Yeah, absolutely. And so what bothers so many people is getting back to men and women that are still holed up in what has been reportedly, you know, very, very difficult conditions in the DC jail. And it seems to me utterly reprehensible, given the fact that despite ongoing long-term nightly attacks on the Portland federal courthouse, those people, I mean, you know, maybe some of them did time, but that was just an ongoing thing whereby they would be released and they'd be out the following day, you know, doing damage or trying to burn it down or fire industrial size municipal fireworks at the building. I mean, unbelievable, you know, there's such a double standard, you know.
Yeah, they did things like aim green lasers at FBI agents to try to blind them, and firebombing the courthouse, which that, by definition, the courthouse was closed for quite a while, interrupting an official government proceeding. The very charges, felony charges, used against many of the January Sixers for delaying congressional counting by 6 hours. You had cases of weeks and weeks where the courthouse in Portland was closed because of the firebombing. So you raise a very valid point, and defense attorneys have tried to raise that. So far, to no avail. It hasn't convinced any of the D.C. judges, but these things may get a different look once they are pushed up on appeal, probably to the Supreme Court, because the D.C. appeals court, you know, a lot of people expect that to back up what's been done by the D.C. District Court judges. But, right. You know, there's a lot of the defense lawyers are playing appeal right now. They're laying the foundation because they just don't feel they're going to get a fair trial.
Right. And so then we look at the whole the pillars of national government, the presidency, this legislative branch, the judicial branch. Is it pretty clear that I mean, would you say it's irrefutable that the White House tried to get National Guard units on hand to be able to, you know, protect the Capitol or Pentagon assets or something, whereby so that there would be some sort of a manpower just to be able to block access?
Yes, we deal with that in the later part of our film. Kash Patel, who was the chief of staff to the acting defense secretary at the time, Chris Miller, he lays out what happened in very, very plain, simple language. So on January 3rd, there was a meeting in Trump's office in the White House, and it was on some other topic. There was some sort of military operation going on overseas. But when they were done talking about that, President Trump said one more thing. And he brought up January 6th and asked about what the plans were. And he said, well, if you need National Guard troops, I authorize you to utilize up to 20,000, not just in D.C., anywhere they're needed, but up to 20,000. And he gave them that verbal authorization, which Kash Patel said that the Defense Department then took that. And under U.S. law, again, the National Guard cannot be ordered into D.C. or any state by the president. They have to be requested by the head of state, you know, the governor, or in this case, it's the mayor of D.C., Muriel Bowser. And she was offered troops per the president's offer, and as was the Capitol Police and Nancy Pelosi and Mitch McConnell, who oversee the sergeants-at-arms in each house. And nobody took him up on that offer. And, you know, you see that rather disingenuous attempt to muddy the waters by Liz Cheney, who said, kept repeating, you know, well, the president didn't order the National Guard. Well, no, he didn't, because that would have been
he
a
can't.
Violation of law. Right.
Of course he's constitutionally can't, but which is just so dishonest to make a statement
is.
Like
and,
that.
And, yeah, and that I think that shows you the lengths that that committee is going to lay down a narrative, and you know that would have been more than adequate force had they accepted that.
Oh, yeah.
And put in, you know, and they probably would have put up different barriers, you know, heavier barriers than these flimsy bicycle racks. And
that was a joke.
So yeah, so the offer was there, it was approved. And it was officially rejected, and And Muriel Bowser, in fact, put her rejection letter out on Twitter. You can still find it. And these things were also noted in the Inspector General's report on January 6th, the Defense Department. So the record is very clear, but it took a while for that to get laid down. There was a lot of bad information floating around about that, claiming that President Trump was indifferent, and when in fact Kash Patel quoted him saying, "I want this to be a safe event for everyone," and that's why he offered the troop level that he did.
That's what Trump said, right?
Yes.
And he said, "Be peaceful and patriotic," right? Now, yep. Also, you've got, you know, I mean, honestly, what could President Trump do at that point? They had already kind of baked into it that it would be an event whereby, you know, people could have stirred up a crowd. Bad actors could have, let's just call them rowdy actors, boisterous, drunken actors, lawbreakers, disorderly discon people, disorderly conduct-minded people could have just gotten in there and just created havoc and, you know, a free-for-all. I think that the Andrew Jackson inauguration, you know, people standing on the chairs with muddy shoes, but, you know, breaking windows and all that. But, I mean, worse. Being called, you know, a new date of infamy like 9/11 or you know, Pearl Harbor, just ridiculous. Well, let's cut to the chase. Where can we get this documentary? How can people buy it? You know, compensate the great people that have put this together. You know, how can they get access to this documentary, Joseph?
There's two main places you can get it. You can go to Epoch TV. It's EPOCH TV, all one word, .com. Yeah. You will find it on there. And there's also a landing page for the film at J6, the numeral 6, realstory.com. And there's some background information on how we put the film together. And it is free for subscribers, and you can get start as a subscriber.
Yeah, Epic Times, okay.
Yeah, you can get 2 months for a buck. But non-subscribers want to see it and stay a non-subscriber, it's $19.99, but... You know, why not put that as an investment into that'll
Epic
take
Times.
A good chunk of subscription. Yeah, so
absolutely.
You know, we're seeing a lot of people do that. So, so then it's free, and it's definitely worth the investment in time. You know, I think from what we've seen and the reaction we've gotten, people had no idea of much of what we put forth.
Yeah, and one thing I just remembered. I forgot this quickly. 30 seconds on Brian Sitnik. Was Brian, Officer Brian Sitnik, killed by Trump supporters?
No, he was not. There was no fire extinguisher tossed at his head. That was a story the New York Times put out that they had to retract. He died of natural causes the next day. He had a stroke. So, you know, the medical examiner did not indicate that anything to do with what happened on the 6th or anything he encountered were contributing factors to his death. Yet
no head trauma.
Benny Thompson and others continue to say that he was killed on January 6th. Well, he wasn't killed, period. You know, he died of natural causes. People can speculate, you know, what leads to a stroke. You know, but
sure.
That's that gets
right, of
into
course.
Dicey territory. So, and yeah, it was a natural causes death, and it was not on January 6th. You know, certainly very tragic, but it's just one of those points that continues to get misstated, I guess, to put it kindly.
Right, and then, but did he have any head trauma? Is there any indication that he had head trauma?
Any indication of any head trauma. Any sort of injuries that would have led them to say it's a contributing factor. He was sprayed with pepper spray. Now, there are two men charged with that, but there's some video evidence that's just coming out that indicates he may very well have been sprayed by another officer and not by these men that are charged. So we'll have to follow up on that, but so there's a case of exculpatory evidence that defense attorneys need to get a hold of.
Right. Okay. Well, listen, Joseph Hahnemann, Epoch Times investigative reporter, the the documentary film that Joseph is the scriptwriter for, right, Joseph?
Yes.
The real story of January 6th. And so, yeah, so folks, check it out. Subscribe to Epic Times. Joseph mentioned a couple of different ways you can get access to this great film. And, yeah, Godspeed to you and the people at Epic Times for spending so much time on this incredibly important topic that has been so misrepresented and has formed part of a narrative, I think, to divide the country further and to demonize people who don't deserve it. Joseph, thanks a million for being on the Bill McIntosh Show, and hope to have you on again.
You're listening to Quorum Radio.
Hey, folks, I'm on today with Charles Brandt, and in case you don't know who he is, well, you sure know about the movie The Irishman. He wrote the book, I Heard You Paint Houses, upon which the movie The Irishman was done by Martin Scorsese, Netflix, Joe Pesci, Al Pacino, Robert De Niro, okay, that group of incredible actors were all involved with The Irishman movie, but Charlie Brandt wrote the book upon which it was all based, I Heard You Paint Houses, and he's from New York. He was born and raised in New York City. He's a former junior high school English teacher, welfare investigator in East Harlem. He was a homicide prosecutor and chief deputy attorney general of the state of Delaware. In private practice since 1976, Brandt was elected president of the Delaware Trial Lawyers Association and the Delaware chapter of the American Board of Tribal Advocates. He's been named by his peers as, quote, one of the best lawyers in America. And he's a frequent speaker on the topic of cross-examination and interrogation techniques for reluctant witnesses. Charlie Brandt is the author of a novel based on major crime he solved through interrogation called The Right to Remain Silent. And he's going to talk to us today about his friendship with Frank Sheeran, the Teamster official known as The Irishman.
So without further ado, let me bring him on. But I cannot forget also that he wrote a book with Joe Pistone called Unfinished Business, which I, by the way, I mentioned that yesterday, Charlie. I gave you a really shameless plug.
Radio. I love Joe.
Anyway, so Charlie, how did you get to know Frank Sheeran?
Well, I got a call one day. I was doing medical legal work, medical malpractice, and I got a call one day from a guy who was representing the Philadelphia mob. And he told me that Frank Sheeran, who was the number one suspect in Hoffa's disappearance, and we all knew that he'd been profiled in the New York Times and Newsweek as the suspect of the presumed death of Jimmy Hoffa, and he was in jail for 32 years for labor racketeering, but he had developed some health problems, and they needed a medical lawyer to see if I could get him out on early parole based on his poor health. And I did that. And while he was in prison, he read a book of mine called The Right to Remain Silent that you mentioned, a book that is now in reissue. It just was re-released again a little while ago. But it first came out in 1988. And he read the book. It's a law and order book. And it's a pro-police book. It's got an interesting premise, and when he read that book, he sought me out when he got out of jail, and he told me that he wanted to write a book, and he wanted me to write it for him, and I knew from my years of experience teaching interrogation that this was a man who wanted to be interrogated. Believe it or not, it's a common phenomenon of those who want to get something off their chest because they feel better when they do, and they really do. Yep. Getting it off their chest. Right. So he sought me out. He took me to lunch. He said his cover story was he was tired of being written about in all the books on Hoffa as the suspect. And he wanted to tell his side of it, and he'd like me to write the book. And so I agreed to meet with him at his apartment outside of Philly in Springfield, Pennsylvania. And we spent 5 hours together. And during the course of that 5 hours, he admitted to far more than he had intended to. And when we were done for the night, he didn't want me back.
You know, I know everybody and their dog. has a MyPillow discount code. I'm here to tell you, number one, a quick secret, all the codes are the same. Doesn't matter who you use. You can use a big site code or a small site code. You can get your code from Mike Lindell himself, and it will always be the same discount. That's something that, again, you know, I know that a lot of publications are out there, a lot of podcasts tell you, oh, you know, use this code for the absolute best discount. Technically, they're not lying. Because it is the best discount, it's just because everybody gets the same discount. I am here to ask you, my friendly, loyal, wonderful viewers, watchers, listeners, all of you, that if you use promo code JDR at checkout at MyPillow.com, you won't just be supporting a great company, a great America First company in MyPillow. You won't just be supporting a very strong patriot in Mike Lindell. You won't even just be supporting your neck with the wonderful, amazing products, like 150 different products there. Dog beds, pillows, of course, sheets, comforters, slippers, all kinds of good stuff. You won't just be supporting those things. You'll be supporting us, and we greatly, greatly appreciate all the support we can get. We're not the biggest show out there. We're not the biggest group out there, but you know, we appreciate every bit of support that we can get. So use promo code JDR at checkout and get the maximum discount possible.
And yeah, man. And eight years later, he returned. His daughter Dolores, who appears in the movie, not the daughter appears in the movie, the character of the daughter appears in the movie. And she had taken him to St. Dorothy's Church in Springfield, outside of Philly, and had a private session with the Monsignor Heldesor. And he got absolution for his sins, but he still wanted to talk to me. He still had that original desire to say the words of that the priest doesn't ask. He may say to the priest, I committed the mortal sin of taking a man's life. Yeah. The priest doesn't say, who was he? What was it about?
What was it? What?
Give me more. Yeah. But he knew I did. So he told his mafia buddies in the Philadelphia Angelo Bruno crime family, and in the upstate Pennsylvania crime family of Russell Buffalino, he told everyone that I was going to write this book for him that cleared him. In the meantime, he knew that he was serially confessing to me. And we spent 5 years with touring his soul and touring the mob. I got to be around some interesting characters. Because he was so respected, whatever he said he was doing, that was okay with Russell and okay with whoever, Russell Buffalino, played by Joe Pesci in the movie. So we spent 5 years.
So I have two quick questions, Charlie. Two quick questions. Sure. One is, A, sometimes the movie doesn't always get it right, right? And in this case, of course, the subpart of this is, do you think the Irishman was faithful to the story that as told to you by Frank Sheeran? Do you think that was accurate?
Totally.
The movie depiction?
They put me up in Marty Scorsese, Bob De Niro, and the screenwriter Steve Zalian put me up in a hotel on the corner of Broadway and 54th Street. And Marty lives on the other side of the Central Park, on the other side of the park. And they gave me a script, the latest script, and they sent for me. And I spent the summer of 2017 from June through August having these script meetings with them.
You were a consultant.
I'm sorry?
You were a paid consultant on the movie.
Well, I was absolutely a consultant on the movie, and specifically on the screenplay, to make sure that it got it right, and they were getting it right, but they wanted me. It was an interesting thing growing up in New York City. When I would come out in the morning at the corner of Broadway and 54th, before I headed to my right to Marty's house, I would look to my left and say a little prayer because I was looking at a New York Telephone Company building that I worked on in 1960 as a timekeeper. And here I was these many years later on my way to a meeting at the greatest filmmaker who ever lived and the greatest
wow.
actor and the greatest screenwriter. And
wow.
And I would look at that building and remember how as a 18-year-old timekeeper working on that building, it was my job to deliver messages all across the beams that were put up. And I would have five stories below me to my death if I slipped. And
wow.
here I was walking the beams for $65 a week. And boy,
wow.
did I have a lot to be grateful for heading over to Marty's house.
Wow. So, like, Charlie,
and they were
just
very.
Go ahead.
What?
No, you
very
go ahead.
Receptive. They were very receptive to what I had to say.
So, Charlie,
very appreciative of it. And, go ahead.
No, I was going to ask you, what was the neighborhood in New York City? I know you went to Stuyvesant High School. Where exactly did you live? I mean, you don't have to give me the address, Charlie.
Well, I lived I lived in Ridgewood, which is on the Brooklyn. Well, I first lived in Staten Island for 3 years. My grandparents had a little Italian farm, and I lived there. And then we moved to the Brooklyn-Queens border, a place called Ridgewood, which is
yeah.
in which the film was made. An awful lot of the film was shot in Ridgewood, disguised to be Philadelphia.
Uh-huh.
And so if you're watching the film and any of the bricks are orange in color, light-colored
yeah.
bricks, that's the
yeah.
style of Ridgewood.
Yeah.
So, and then from Ridgewood, we moved to Flushing in
okay.
Queens,
sure.
where people had lawns.
Wow.
We not only
you're moving up in the world,
didn't
Charlie.
Have lawns, we not only didn't have lawns in Ridgewood, you know, we didn't have bathtubs.
Oh, my
we
gosh.
We didn't have telephones. Yeah,
gosh,
I didn't dial a telephone until we moved to Flushing.
Wow, so then...
So anyway, that was my era.
That was your place in Queens and Brooklyn right there. Now, but when you, so
yeah.
did you live in...
Oh, and then I lived in Brooklyn. I went to Brooklyn Law School and I lived in Brooklyn.
Okay, but did you went to Sty High. Was that... Were you living in Brooklyn when you went to Stuyvesant High School, or where were you living?
No, I was living in Flushing. It was a four-year, I spent 4 years in Stuyvesant High School from 55 to 59. And all of those were a nice commute from Flushing.
Yeah. Wow, so
but, you
amazing.
Know, it had the reputation as the best school in the city, and, you know, you get caught up in it.
Oh, absolutely. And I remember they were one of the first schools to, I think probably in the world, maybe in the world, to have a cyclotron. It was pretty amazing. Stuyvesant High School.
Excuse me, my senior class. It was the senior class project making a cyclotron.
Right, but that was, of course, but it was also the senior class project to have a roving crap game, which I think, weren't you in charge of? Weren't you the manager?
Well, it was. It was a card game. I kept the card game going, you know, in our last semester in school. I was the official guy. That's funny
right.
that you remember that. That's cool.
Of course, Charlie. You told me these great little anecdotes. I'm a New Yorker, and I love this stuff. So.
Hey, Charlie, one of the most fascinating anecdotes in the book, I Heard You Paint Houses, which, of course, was the basis of the movie The Irishman, there was a secret mafia trial. You attended that with Frank.
Yes, I did. Our first meeting, I met him at his apartment. Well, it was our second meeting. We had gone to lunch first. And that's when he proposed that I write this book. But we then met in his apartment in Springfield, and we were going to work on me questioning him. I went to the bathroom, the phone rang, and when I came out, he was on the phone with somebody and being very respectful. Yes, yes, yes. And it turned out that he had requested a trial in the mob world. When he went to jail 10 years earlier, he felt that these two guys that were collecting money for him on a loan shark debt had kept the money for themselves and that he was entitled to this. They were supposed to be collecting $1,500 a week. And they give you no notice. He said, you know, you don't get any notice. You don't do it when they want to do it. And look at the respect I get. They only do this for Italians, and they're going to have this for me. And so we went to this trial at the Mona Lisa restaurant at just off South Street, and it was loaded wall to wall gangsters. And I met Big Billy D'Elia there, who was the boss of the Russell Bufalino crime family. That was where I met him. I met John Stanfa, who was then the boss of the Bruno, the old Bruno crime family. Stanfa was from Sicily. And when he was arrested on 5 murder charges and sent to Leavenworth, I have his Christmas card that he sent Frank. I still have Stanfa's Christmas card. And Frank was named as an unindicted co-conspirator in the trial against Stanfa. They didn't arrest Frank. They didn't try to convict him of anything to do with Stanfa's work. But he was mobbed up with Stanfa, and that was brought out at the trial and in the indictment. The mob trial lasted 5 hours, and when it was over, the two guys that he was suing, he was represented by Billy D'Elia, and Stanfa was the judge, and Stanfa's underboss was representing the two guys. The two guys claimed that they had turned the money over as they collected it to little Nicky Scarfo, who was the boss of the Philly crime family just before John Stanfa. And he was in jail. And when in those days, when they put you in jail, they put you in jail for like 4 life terms. So Stanfa was waiting his turn. But at that moment, it was a little Nicky Scarfo that was in jail. And they claimed, the two torpedoes claimed, that they had given the money as they collected it to Scarfo. And from jail, Scarfo testified that he was not given their money. He was given his own half of it that he was entitled to, but he was not given their money. Right. So at the end of the trial, Frank won the trial. He was the two guys were ordered to pay him $1,500 a week until he told them he could stop. And then we got to his apartment, and that's when we began our 5-year. We began our questioning, and he gave me far more than he intended, as the book lays out. As the I heard you paint out.
After that decision in his favor by the mob's judges and the mob court, did Frank open a bottle of whiskey and celebrate a little bit? It turned out his favor, right?
And actually, he was drinking. It did. He was, and I say it in the book, he was drinking wine, and that there's an old saying about in vino veritas, in wine is the truth. And he was drinking at the meeting, and we didn't stop off afterwards. We just went to his apartment, and I picked up where I left off with him, which was I was about to start interrogating him. And I spent 5 more hours. That trial was 5 hours, you know, with kibitzing and all that they do.
Wow.
And I basically sat at the bar just so I could reach out and touch him, but I wasn't a part of it. And then when we got home his house, the guy that was with us and doing the driving decided to go home, and I had Frank to myself. And I then had him for 5 hours.
So, being somebody who's spent a lot of times in a legit courtroom, what was it like? The jurisprudence of the mob? Did they have, you know, discovery of evidence and cross examination and all those things, or is it a little bit more rudimentary than formal?
Yes, to all of that, they had already gotten statements from. They had already gotten statements from other people that had relevant evidence, and those statements were introduced. You know, what do you mean you didn't? What do you mean? Nicky didn't get that money. Yeah. He told, you know, somebody else that he never got it. And then some character witness would say, yeah, if Nicky got the money, he'd have turned it over. You know, character evidence, you know.
Yeah.
And they were cross-examined, you know. Yeah, Billy D'Elia cross-examined the two guys. He did a good job. the two guys that owed the money. And basically, he was being a nice guy, saying, "You don't want this reputation. You don't want this reputation. You want this to be handled the right way, handled appropriately." And I think they thought, you know, whether we were right or wrong, we're going to walk out of this with a bad reputation unless we give up the money.
Decorating a carpet.
Yeah. So they knew, and he knew not to abuse them.
Wow.
That he was going to just take a certain amount and not be a pig. Yeah, I left all that out of the first edition of the book because I knew that Billy D'Elia didn't like me, he didn't trust me, and I gave a very shortened, abridged version of what happened that night. And then later, when Billy went bad, so to speak, and became a government informant, government cooperating witness, then we did a reissue of the book. And added a conclusion chapter of 57 pages. This is a book that just grew and grew as more things came in that corroborated what Frank told me.
One quick interjection. This is the book I Heard You Paint Houses.
Yeah,
that had the 57 page addendum of evidentiary material to basically rebut the naysayers of those who said, "Hey, it never happened." So, Charlie, so you're there with Frank Sheeran in the apartment, drinking a bottle of wine. It probably became two because Frank was like, "What?"
We weren't drinking anymore. we got home, we got to the apartment, and he had toned down his drinking, although he had been known as an unbelievable drinker in his day. After he got out of jail, he had toned it down for a while. In the beginning, he drank more. After Hoffa disappeared in 75, it drove him to drink. But after a while, he was afraid that if he fell, he was home alone and drinking and fell, he wouldn't be able to get up because of his arthritis. As a function of his arthritis, his drinking lowered its volume because he was legendary for how much he could drink, especially, you know, Joe Pistone will tell you, for your listeners from yesterday, every Thursday when Joe came into town, into New York City posing as a jewel thief and he was an associate of the Bonanno crime family.
Right.
Every Thursday, he'd go to Russell Bufalino's restaurant in Manhattan, the Vesuvius, with Frank Sheeran. And just in case,
is that right?
Russell liked to buy jewelry. I'd like to fence jewelry for cat burglars, and he had two jewelry stores on Jewelers Row. On 47th Street in Manhattan, across street from the Fox News Channel. And he, Joe will tell you that this was right after Hoffa disappeared, that Frank was drinking like crazy then.
Charlie. This is fascinating. So you're saying that so that Joe Pistone, under the moniker of Donnie Brasco, was helping defense for Russell Bufalino, stolen jewelry and things like that, right?
He was offering for sale jewelry that the FBI had from other sting operations or whatever.
Of course.
And he would say to Russell, "I got something new you might be interested in," and he'd show it to him, and if Russell liked it, Russell would buy it, and Joe would turn that money over to the evidence people at the FBI.
Wow.
And so,
fascinating.
You know, he was trying to, it was part of his effort to infiltrate these people. He had already infiltrated the Bonanno family.
Wow. Fascinating. Because it looks like he got more than more families. Right.
Oh yeah. Russell was quite a powerful man. and for Joe to get near him was a big deal.
Yeah, so I want to get off. That's a fascinating digression, but I don't want to go there because I have a really fascinating story with our friend Russell Buffalino, who got to know Frank Sheeran. How did they get to know each other? When and where did that take place?
Well, it took place, and the movie depicts it beautifully. Frank was working for Food Fair, the food company, as a trucker, mostly doing refrigerated trucks, selling meat. And his truck broke down outside of Syracuse, New York. And this older Italian man came over to him and said, "Can I give you a hand getting it started?" And that older Italian man was Russell Buffalino, who was not only one of the most powerful mafia bosses the world has ever known, but he was also a master mechanic. He had worked at the Canada Dry Company as a mechanic. And so he got the rig started, or as they call it, the horse. He got my horse started, Frank said. And he asked me a lot of questions about myself, because Frank was, as you know, 6'4", 220 pounds, and easily the toughest human being that ever lived, you know.
Yeah.
And Russell was maybe 5'4" or something, and Russell took a shine to this man, who it turns out was able to speak Italian. Frank knew Italian. He grew up in an Italian neighborhood, and he used to have to fight his way to school. Fight the Italians on his way to school. Wow. But he could speak a certain amount of it. And then in the war, he was stationed in Italy. He was in the Italian campaign, 411 combat days, and in all the major battles, Salerno, Anzio, southern France, Sicily. And he cultivated his Italian during the war. Frank was very bright and a quick study, and very witty, and so he started talking the Sicilian dialect to Russell Buffalino.
And Russell was of Sicilian descent?
Yes, he was a Sicilian.